Hello again, and welcome to Victory Laps, part of the Throwback Thursday celebrations for the 50th anniversary of Riverside International Speedway. I'm Dylan Langille, and thanks again for pressing play at riversidespeedway.ca or clicking download on iTunes. And if you listen on iTunes or Apple Podcasts, click on subscribe. You'll never miss an upcoming episode. Here we are, coming to the final event of 2019 at Riverside, but how about that bumper-to-bumper 300 weekend? Great weather both days, along with three tremendous races. Plus, we had over 60 cars and trucks show up for the first Rev It Up at Riverside Show and Shine. Thank you so much for that. We had a barn burner for the lone East Coast NASCAR Pinty Series race, and it had to go to NASCAR overtime. Jason Hathaway collected his second victory at Riverside. What a race. What a finish. And I caught up with Jason after his thrilling win. Plus, I also want to share my conversation with a driver who not only competed in the East Coast Mini Stock Tour race this year, he also drove at Riverside in 1969. Before Jason, let's hear what Jerome Tracy had to say before his race. We're here at the Bumper to Bumper 300 weekend. It's the Friday night, Henry's Auto Pro 100, and the Passion Flooring and Interiors 50 for the East Coast Mini Stock Tour. One driver who's racing here tonight also raced here on opening day 1969, along with Frank Fraser, who raced in the Sportsman at the IWK 250 weekend. Jerome Tracy, back in the car this weekend. Jerome, 50 years is a long time. Great to have you back here at Riverside.
Well, it's good to be back. 50 years ago was good, but this is better.
Do you remember that opening day of 1969 or the beginnings of hearing about Riverside opening up?
Yeah, I remember the, I think there were maybe two races the previous year. And it's towards the end of the year anyway, but I do remember the opening.
Were you a racer before the track opened up, or was this your first foray into racing?
No, my first race was 1961, Namaha River on the Dirt.
And compared to the dirt racing here on the high banks for the very first time, for many other drivers too, must have been a big change.
Oh, it's a big change. You have to get used to it. It's almost like a whole new ball game.
What are some of your memories here racing at Riverside over those 50 years?
I don't know, there's too many of them.
Any that stick out in particular?
No, I just remember, you know, racing with Rowley and John Chisholm, Frank Fraser, Caleb Dunn, Jim Hallahan, a whole bunch of those. Can't remember them.
What was the first car you drove here?
I drove a 65 Mustang Fastback.
So it's a little different from a Honda Civic you're going to be racing tonight.
Oh, way different.
Compared... Really, the big difference is, I mean, you got a, is it a front-wheel drive Honda, and then compared to the old Mustang?
It's front-wheel drive, and it's hard to get used to. I'm still not, this is my third year with the Tour, and I still can't get onto the front wheel.
But it's all about the fun, right?
Oh, it's all fun, you know, and just being able to do it.
So what are your expectations racing on the high banks here in 2019?
I just want to try to finish the race. I don't care where I finish.
It's all just about being here?
Just being here, yeah.
Who were some people that helped you 50 years, 50 plus years of racing? It sounds like nearly 60 years of racing.
Oh, there were a lot of Bill Durkee from Yarmouth. He was a car salesman at Fairley and Stevens in Dartmouth, where I worked. So that was the first car we decided to build one for Namaha River. And oh, there was a whole crew of people. Everybody chips in and helps, you know. So it's not one person, just a whole bunch of everybody.
So you'd be happy just finishing the race. Are you going to be racing at the other East Coast Mini Stock Tour race here at Riverside?
Yeah, I want to do that one. Try to do that one, and that may be the end of it.
Well, thank you for racing 50 years. You're here opening day along with Frank, and Frank got a top 10 in his sporting race. Maybe you can do the same.
Oh, I just want to finish. I'm not worried about that.
Jerome Tracy, thank you so much for taking time to do this.
You're welcome. Thanks.
It's the end of the Bumper to Bumper 300 at Riverside International Speedway. Probably the craziest finish I've ever seen in my life watching live racing. Jason Hathaway, couple maneuvers to win this race. What do you got to say about that? I was speechless.
Short track race in the NASCAR Pinty Series. That's the way we do it. I mean, there's. I always tell everybody it's always quality over quantity in this series and car counts and so on. And just the drivers in this series are so good and the cars are so close. And it's just you get an opportunity, you got to take it.
You've had history here at Riverside. You've come and raced in the Parts for Trucks Pro Stock Tour. You were involved in a pretty big wreck a year or so ago. You raced the IWK 250. What does it mean to win the Bumper to Bumper 300 right here?
Hey, pretty special. I won back in like 2013 as well, and sat in the pole at the IWK. We never had any real good finishes in the IWK, but I love coming out here. And it's just a great racetrack. I love coming here, and we got friends and family out here that Chisholms are, you know, they're pretty much family to us. They come to our place, we go to their place, we vacation all winter, and it's just nice to come out here. It's one of the nicest tracks in Canada, nestled in Antigonish, Nova Scotia, and it's a hell of a racetrack. I love coming.
You had some great battles with DJ Kennington, and then Lacroix came out of nowhere on the green white checkered, gave you a little bumper, you gave it back. That was just short track racing at its finest.
Oh, for sure. I was expecting it from either one of those guys, whoever could get to my back bumper in 3 and 4. And actually, I thought it was going to be Kennington, and I looked up and it was red cars. It was Lacroix. So once he got by me, I stood on the gas there and gave it back to him, and I'm sure he was expecting it just like I was.
We had a great crowd here. We had a lot of fans watching on the internet as well. Why should a race fan come to the Bumper to Bumper 300? Why should they be here next year?
Wow, that's the show we put on. Every year we come here, it's always like that. It's always good finishes. It's always a shootout with 10 or 20 to go. And then the NASCAR Pinty Series puts on the best racing around. I mean, I've been to them all. I've been to all the tracks and all the series. I've raced in all the series. And even back home in Ontario, we've got great series there too. But you can't beat the NASCAR Pinty Series for the talent-wise and some of these guys. You got Alex Tagliani, he's an Indy 500 pole sitter, you know what I mean? Like, it's just, you know, that's the talent that you get in here. So it's pretty special to win this, take that trophy home.
Tag finished third, DJ Kennington finished second. Jason Hathaway finishes first. Congratulations, winning your second Bumper to Bumper 300.
Thanks a lot.
Back of the IWK 250 weekend, Cassius Clark drove his King Racing number 13 across the start-finish line in first. The owner of that number 13 was one happy camper, and he's my next guest on Victory Laps. Let's hear from Maritime Racing legend Rolly McDonald. He is a member of both the Maritime and Canadian Motorsports Hall of Fame. He's the owner of King Racing. Maritime Racing legend, big Rolly McDonald, joins me on Victory Laps today. Rolly, how are you?
I'm great. Yeah, just getting back from Oxford, getting on wound air, and getting ready to go for the weekend.
Yeah, I understand it was a busy time with Cassius racing in the 250. Got himself a top 10.
Yeah, we did. We were a better car than what we showed, just a couple things bitters there late in the race, so ended up 8th.
And it's been a great year for you and your team. Two 250 wins, at least recording this, the CAT 250 and the IWK 250 with Cassius Clark. I mean, you must be one happy owner.
I am, yeah. Pretty proud of the boys. You know, it's just not Cassius, and it's not any one guy in our crew. It's the whole crew, and certainly Andrew Hickson that puts our cars together here in the shop, and my crew chief, he's a big part of it. He leads the whole deal, and he's put together a real good crew here in the last couple of years, and the guys are staying together, so that's what makes it all work. It's a team effort.
And with the IWK 250, I mean, that car dominated. There was a late race caution. Did you get a little butterflies towards the end there once Cassius did have himself a sizable lead that did shrink?
Well, I always do, because we had a, you know, pretty good lead at the time, and then that incident happened in the pits. And when you sit around for 45 minutes or probably close to 50 or 60 minutes, you have the chance of tires going down, you know, because things do leak off. Air drops and that, because the tires are losing their the heat out of them, and the pressure drops down. So I was nervous, and our car, you know, it usually takes 3 or 4 laps to get going after we sit for a while. So no, I was nervous. I mean, we led the race most of the way, and hated to lose it over that. But anyway, it all worked out good in the end.
Absolutely. So let's talk about your career, Rolly. You've been around the racing scene for a long, long time. What sparked your interest in racing?
Well, when I was young, believe it or not, bicycles was my way of life. My dad and mom, we always had enough on the table to eat and everything, but we had no big money or anything, so we used to give their beer bottles to and pop bottles, and I think there were a cent a dozen back then to get enough money to buy a bicycle, and me and my friends did that, and you know, bicycles were, I think they were around $14 or $15, but that's still a lot of bottles at a cent a piece. So anyway, and it was always a deal. I had the first three-speed bicycle in my community. I mean, it was racing. We used to race bikes. We used to jump them over jumps and do all that crazy stuff that kids do. And so I was a bit of a speed, not right from day one, I guess. Nobody else in my family is, other than my grandson now, but my brothers, my sisters, nobody like that were, and my mom and dad certainly weren't. So I don't know where I actually got it from, but I always like to go fast.
When was the first time you stepped in a race car?
I did a little bit of drag racing in 63, even some in the 65. And I found that 64, late 64, I built my first old race car. It was a six-cylinder oval track car on a dirt track up here. But the drag racing, I got out of that because it was too short. If you made one little mistake, you've lost the race. I figured with oval track racing, you have, 25 laps at least to make a mistake and regain it. So that's why I liked oval track racing.
Was that Fraser Mountain Raceway?
Yes. Yeah.
And then you raced there for a few years, and you were a young man when Riverside really started, when John got the idea. Did you hear grumblings about a big giant track in Atlanta and Antigonish?
Yeah, well, I knew the Chisholm family a little bit because I had the dump trucks back then and that. I started dump trucking in 64, too, so I was around working different areas, different places. Actually, when they built the Speedway there, I was working in Cape Breton and Port Hawkesby at an oil refinery with the dump trucks and going by there, quite often and seeing the progress John was making. And we couldn't wait to get on it. That was like a Daytona to us, coming off the flat little bull ring. So we'd never drove on a bank track like that. Even down in Maine, I was doing some racing down there, and they're all flat tracks. So that was a big deal. That was probably the highlight of my career, forever, I guess, really, to have a track like that built in their backyard. I mean, that was the mini Bristol of Canada, so it was terrific to have John do that. It really brought racing alive around here.
And you were at the first race at Riverside?
I was, yes, and I don't know exactly where I finished, but I know I was there. I think I had a 65 Comet, I think I raced that year there. Yeah. Anyway, the Chevy motor in. I'm not much of a Ford motor fan, so I had a Chevy motor in it.
You go from a flat track like Fraser Mountain Raceway to Riverside. I mean, that's a night and day difference, right?
Oh, night and day, yeah. And, there was a lot of figuring it out for springs and everything. We certainly put heavier springs in it, but what I could remember about Riverside, like in the flat track, you slide around a lot and that, and we had big motors back then, believe it or not. We'd run bigger motors than we do today, and there was no tire rules, so we had big, wide, sticky tires on it, and it was fast. When it throws you into a corner, not so much on a flat track, but because the cars didn't handle all that great, even with the big tires, but you get the Riverside and you got all that fresh asphalt and that, and the bite is tremendous, and you roll into the corner there. And we were going darn near as fast, when that place was built, as we are today. We could run around there in 14.6, 14.7s, and it was pretty quick back then, and they were just, we call them jalopies, I guess, compared to today.
Yeah, like I've chatted with Jim Hallahan before about the jalopy racing, and, with all these great drivers racing the first times, were there any notable races for yourself in the early goings of Riverside?
I had a couple of bad wrecks there, I know that, and I won a lot of races there. I got a lot of trophies out in the shelf, but it's so long ago now, I'd have to go out and look and see what dates were on, I'll tell you the truth.
Yeah, and to, unfortunately, dig up some of the bones about the wrecks, I had a chance to chat with Bobby Allen a few months ago, and he talked about his pretty nasty wreck in the late 70s and 77, and yourself was involved in that wreck. Is that a big memory for you?
Yeah, it was. I still remember that night because Bobby's car went right over the top of mine and landed up near the top of the rail, and Bobby hurt his back there or whatever. And no, that was pretty scary. I got turned going into turn one. I think it was Jimmy Hallahan got into my right rear, turned me around. We hit the wall, impact head on, and destroyed the front frame section of my car, but it bounced around. And turned facing the traffic, and Bobby was the next car to come up on top of me, and he rode right up over my car, right into the top of the rail. So I got out of it. Actually, I didn't get hurt other than shaken up, but Bobby got hurt in that accident.
And that's just one of the unfortunate parts of racing, and to kind of sidetrack, you've also had your fair share of a pretty nasty wreck, which did injure you significantly, right?
Oh, I did in Halifax there, yeah. We were going for 22 wins in a row there with a Dodge. I drove for another guy there, Peter Sutherland, a Scotsman. We worked on the car. It was a petty kit car. And we were going for 22 wins in a row. That was 1978. Same idea of an accident. we crossed the line, and the guy gave us the white flag. I was in second spot, and we caught a lap car in the corner in turns one and two. That was a half-mile Lucasville track, so a very fast track. And coming off of turn two, the guy we passed, the leader went high around him, and I went low, and the car in the middle, the lap car, he turned to the left when he saw the leader on the outside, and he caught my right rear and turned me out through the fence. And, of course, I didn't get my 22nd win. But anyway, I busted up my sternum, and, yeah, it was a bad deal. The door and the car came in on top of me. I mean, the whole frame and everything moved in about a foot. I was sitting in the middle of the car. Thank God the seatbelts held, even though it all got moved in. So it was I can remember that crash, too. But I've never been through anything like it, really, so.
Let's get away from some of the wrecks and talk about some of the good times, including the first 250 race. Did you participate in that?
I'm sure I did, but I didn't win it, I don't think. I won a couple 250s, not the 250, I won a 250 in 1989, but I won a lot of 100 lappers and things down here, and they used to have the twin 75s and the three 50 lappers together. So I won quite a few of them. A lot of trophies out in the shelf there that way, but the 250s, I didn't have a whole lot of luck. All the time something seemed to happen, something in 89, we got that one put together.
What did it take to win the 1989 250 race?
It's durability. Everything went well. I always had a fast car, but a lot of times, I guess I had a little different opinion than some people. I either won or crashed, I tell you. I was going for the win every time I went the race. There was no second spot.
You would go down in flames.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. No, nobody remembers who finished second, right?
Yeah. So who were some of your toughest competitors racing in the 70s and 80s at Riverside? We had drivers, you know, like Frank Fraser and Jim Hallahan do very well. Oh, yeah. Were there anybody else that really dominated Riverside?
Jimmy Hallahan certainly did. There was a few others. Greg Seward, he was strong there. Used to have Joey Baker there from Glasgow. Who else? Well, John Chisholm. I mean, John bought a home in the Moody car in 69, and he raced with us in the 70s, not in the 80s, but he was strong in that car, the home in the Moody car. He brought the first professional race car I'd ever saw, really, to Pictou County, and it was a beautiful piece of work. And John ran good in it. Yeah, George Koskulik in the 80s, he was strong. He helped me some, and then he raced some of my cars, and he had his own cars. Bobby Ewell's another guy out of Halifax that's still around. He doesn't race now, but Bobby was good. There was a lot. There was probably 10 cars that could win back then. It's a lot of good racing. A lot of good racing at Riverside.
I'd probably say the driver who dominated Riverside in the 90s easily, Scott Fraser, winning 5 250s in a row. I mean, Can you share experiencing racing alongside with him and then eventually racing for you?
He did, yeah. I was racing against him through the 90s, and he was tough to beat, I'll tell you that. So I decided, well, what the heck? If I can't beat him, I'll join him, right? Put him in my car. So that's how all that came about. We went to New Smyrna Beach that year in the winter of the Speed Weeks in 99. And, he did run a lot of my cars and ran them well. I mean, Scott ran well in whatever he was in, whether it was his own built stuff or stuff from my stable. He ran well. He was a heck of a guy and a heck of a racer.
And you guys dabbled in ASA for a bit, too, and you had some success there as well.
We had a lot of success. We were a top five car in most of the races, and then the next year we only did 6 races that year. We got going in the middle of the year, and every one was a good outing. Had a lot of fun there, and we traveled all over the Midwest and that, and everybody was saying, where the heck did that come from, or that guy come from? But Scott was right up there with the best of them. And then the following year we decided to do the whole deal, and racing can turn pretty ugly at times, and I mean, nothing to do with Scott driving or whatever, but just getting caught in the wrong places at the wrong time and getting in accidents, right? And it was just one of those no-luck years. You got to have some luck in racing to be on top.
So did you kind of step back a bit when he was running your cars, and did you run in the Maritimes at all during that point?
No, we didn't. For 2 years there, we didn't run here in the Maritimes. So we went concentrated on the ASA deal. And then after that, he came back and ran my cars here. And I ran the Oxford 250 with him, and he never did get to win the Oxford 250. He certainly had fast enough cars, but always something happened, with the car. Something would break or get in an accident or whatever. You know, So he never did get that on his resume. But anyway, he won the Fredericton race there a couple times. One time was in my car, and did a hell of a show there. So he's he was a great racer, car builder. You know, he could do anything. He put his hands to. He was a super guy. So it was a pretty saddened day when they called me. I was in Florida actually when he died that night, and they called me there early in the morning. Wasn't a good day.
Was it a tough choice for you to make the decision to take over the car again?
Well, the car, it was, because I wasn't driving, you know, very good. I seemed to have lost it when I got Scott involved. I was, 50-some years old, 56, 57, probably 58, I don't know. But anyway, I seemed to have lost the touch. And then after Scott died, we had the car in the shop. And the car Scott actually drove, and the year before that, he won the 200 in Halifax, that September. And the last lap he led was the only lap he led for the whole race, and he won the race on the last lap.
That was my very first pro stock race, in fact. I remember that.
Okay, because he raced with, I think it was Sean Turple there, the last 7 or 8 laps on the outside, and he finally got him.
Mm-hmm.
And so he that car was here in the air, or here in my shop, and we'd gone to Concord, North Carolina in November with him, and took his car down and my motor. And he was running fifth there in a 200-lap race, or 250, I guess it was, at Concord. It was about the middle of the race, and a Heim joint broke, and he went into the wall. Nothing to do with his driving, but the damn thing broke. And anyway, crashed that car. So that was his last race he ever sat in a race car. So anyway, but getting back to the car that was here in my shop, I took it to Riverside to test it. And we had a dry sump motor and a steel headed motor. And I was only about 5 laps into the test, me driving, and the oil line blew apart on the dry sump pump. And we impacted the wall hard in turn one and destroyed the front clip on the car. And the car, it was smashed bad. It broke the fuel pump off, and the car went afire and stuff. And so anyway, that was a hard deal. So we come back, and I didn't know what the heck I was going to do then, so we decided to cut the front clip off it and put what we call a Hapke front clip on it. And Dean Clattenburg was working there at Hapke's and from Halifax, and so he put it on for... No, I brought it back. I bought a clip from him, and we took it to Frankie's shop and put it on. That was probably the best move I ever did, and then the following year, I didn't run that car that year. The rest of the year, I sat it out, and the following year, they brought out the crate motor rule, and I was the first guy to put a crate motor in my car. Everybody was sort of laughed at me, but being an old guy, I just said, well, it might suit me, you know, it's a little less horsepower. So I went out, and yeah, we won the championship that following year with that car, and we ran, never missed a lap that year. It was phenomenal. I often thought that Scotty was my guardian angel, because we drove through wrecks and never wrecked it and never got tore up. Anyway, and just amazing how the car ran. And we ran feature laps. I think it was 1,675 feature laps. We finished on the lead lap every time.
So, wow.
Amazing year. Yeah, we went down to Portland, Maine, led a big race down there, finished third 300 lapper that year. We couldn't do anything wrong. One of those years that all you had to do was sit and steer the car. The car was good. I mean, it handled fantastic. We had a heck of a year. So
and you swept Riverside that year, too, in 2005.
That's right, we did. We won the last 2 races there on the old track, yeah.
I was just going to ask that. So that was the last wins pre-renovation. What were the grumblings hearing about John getting the track back and going to completely give it a facelift?
Well, to me, it was like rebuilding Daytona, right, because the track was wore out. And, you know, everything was cutting run down because John had sold the track a number of years before, and the people that had it didn't really have any good money to put back in it, and then they just struggled with it. So, anyway, I had thoughts of buying the track myself, and actually John came here and sat in my house, and we talked about it, and he said, well, I said, John, I had a serious operation in 05, too. It was a deal there in the fall. I actually missed the banquet. I went in the end of October, and the banquet was the end of October, to have a gallbladder taken out, and I ended up in the VG hospital in Halifax for 2 weeks. So I was really set back, and that's when the track was being sold. And the old guy that owned the track, he had died in buying it off the family, and they had given me first chance because I talked about it. But anyway, been laying there and sick for quite a while with my operation and everything. John came up to the house here one night and sat around and talked, and I said, yeah, if you want it, you can do a lot more with it than I can. So he bought it back and just made it the nicest racetrack and anywhere. I mean, not only in Canada, anywhere. And on a short track, you know, a third mile type track, it's, you will not find one any nicer. And I've raced from here to California, Florida, Midwest, all over. I mean, third mile tracks, he's got the best.
Can you really explain what John did for the racing scene here in the Maritimes?
Oh, John loved racing, and without it, the racing wouldn't be what it is here today. I don't know. I couldn't thank John enough, and I actually did thank him different times while he was alive for putting together a facility. And, you know, only 30 miles from my place, it was great. And he was a very good guy. First, if he wanted to rent the track or whatever, it was pretty well always available, you know. So we spent a lot of testing and stuff in that track. And John, racing would not be what it is today without John Chisholm. I mean, he was a racer right from day one, and he loved it. And it was just, I can't believe it's here in our backyard in eastern Canada. And, you know, and I guess, you know, I certainly appreciate it, but as far as good racetracks, it's the best.
And it's 50 years of racing, and the Chisholm legacy continues, and the McDonald racing legacy continues, because your grandson's 16 now. He's made legend starts at Riverside. He's going to make his first pro stock start at the Lucas Oil 150. What does that mean to you as a grandfather and a racer?
Well, him and I tested there a couple of weeks ago, and I haven't drove a car now in 3 years, but the last time I raced at Riverside 3 years ago, I finished fourth in that 150 lapper in June. And that was, I felt pretty darn good, you know, with the outing and that. And I said, well, maybe I'll, you know, it'll be my last race and his first race here come September. But when I tested the car, my health was not up to it. I ran probably 40 laps or so, and I just didn't feel that good in the car. So I guess my grandson is going to start his career 50 years after the old guy did. So I'd like to be there testing him, making sure he does good, and another car pushing him around, but that isn't going to happen. So anyway, no, my grandson's a good kid, and I think he'll do well there. We've tested, and he was two to three tests quicker than me, so I think he's going to do well there.
Austin's got the racing bug.
Yeah, he seems to have, for sure. He's a smart kid, too, Austin. He's very smart in school and that, so he's a good all-around kid, so... Yeah, he does well in the legend cars. He just come back from down there at Oxford. He raced three times down there, finished second twice to a pro. And like the legend cars are, you know, young lion, semi-pro and pros. And pro beat him two nights, but he won out over everybody else, 26 car field. So, and then on Sunday he should have won, but a guy got into his left rear and turned him around. He was leading that race actually for mid race before he lost it. So. Anyway, no, he can handle a car. We raced him at Loudon, New Hampshire, in the mile track the end of June. We took him up there in one of our cars, on the pro stock car, 29-car field, and he ran that race and finished fourth. So that was a good outing for us. So.
We can't wait to see him race in the Maritime Parts and Trucks Pro Stock Tour coming up Saturday, September 7th, Lucas Oil 150. Just to wrap this up, Rolly, and I appreciate your time, what is your favorite memory racing at Riverside International Speedway?
Probably beating Scotty Frazier a couple times. mean, Scotty was the guy to beat. And I raced against Parsons there, too. Benny Parsons, he was there in the 70s. That was a big deal for us. And Benny broke that night, but we were very competitive that night. We had the kit car. So a few things like that. I just loved it every time I go there. And even go practice there a couple of weeks ago with my grandson, and I had my own car there too. I mean, I get excited every time I go through the gates. And that's at 75 years old, 50 years later. So there you go.
Well,
it's been good.
We can't wait to see you again coming up at the Lucas Oil 150. Best of luck to Austin, and best of luck to King Racing. Mark it on your calendar. Saturday, September 7th, it's the Lucas Oil 150 at Riverside International Speedway. It's going to be a great day of racing. And note the start time. Racing begins at 4 p.m., gates open at noon, and along with the East Coast Mini Stock Tour and Napa Sportsman Series, the Parts for Trucks Pro Stock Tour has its final stop at Riverside for 2019. And along with hometown favorites like Donald Chisholm and George Koskulik, we are going to see the debut of an up-and-coming race car driver in a pro stock. He's the grandson of Rolly McDonald, Austin McDonald, and now he's on Victory Laps. He is the grandson of Rolly McDonald. He is set to make his first start in a pro stock at Riverside coming up September 7th at the Lucas Oil 150. It's a pleasure chatting with 16-year-old Austin McDonald. Austin, how are you?
I'm very good, and I also want to thank you for allowing me to be talking to you right now.
Hey, it's a pleasure, of course, and you've had yourself a busy 2019 so far. You've been in the States, you're fresh off racing in Oxford, and you're fresh off actually racing a legend car just at Riverside not that long ago.
Yeah, we had a pretty good run at Riverside a little while ago with Corey Hall. Struggled a little bit, just fought the car, but I mean, that's racing. You always go back the next week and try your best.
What happened in practice? You had a little fire going towards the end there?
Yeah, the oil filter. The fitting came out of the motor and just blew motor oil all over the place, but better than a motor, which we thought it was.
Absolutely. So what's been the highlight so far for you? I mean, you know, you're 15 years old, you're racing Legends in Texas and at Oxford and racing the Pro Stock in New Hampshire. I mean, what has been the highlight so far for 2019?
Probably my biggest highlight would have been Loudon in the late model. I really surprised myself about how good I ran. I really want to thank King Racing for giving me the opportunity and a really good car. I wouldn't have been able to do it without them, and I had a really good run there, and it really surprised me and made me want to pursue pro stock further.
And you've got a lay of the land of Riverside. How excited are you to make your first pro stock start coming up on September 7th?
I'm very excited, especially to run at my grandfather's favorite racetrack. Like, it's all around going to be good times, good memories, and it's really fun for me to know that I'm racing in a place that my grandfather raced at 50 years ago.
And what are your expectations going into this weekend? How many times have you raced at Riverside in the Legend car?
I've raced twice there already in the Legend car, and I've tested the late model a little bit. I mean, I always have high expectations for myself because, as you know, my grandfather, he always pushes me to do my best. I'd really love to put together like a top five run, but who knows if that'll happen. We might do better, we might do worse. I guess we'll have to see when we get there.
And has your grandfather shown you the ropes and given you some advice, and do you feel a little pressure because you're the grandson of a maritime racing legend?
I definitely feel a little pressure there, and I also feel a little pressure racing for King Racing because, I mean, their stuff is the best of the best in the Maritimes, and it's hard to compete and still be learning and yet still try to do well and do your best.
What would make a happy Austin McDonald coming out of the 150, finishing top 10, top 5, or just finishing?
I mean, there's always that goal of finishing because you can't win the race. You got to finish it first. Of course, my goal is to win because that's everybody's goal, but I expect us to hopefully put together a top 5 run, and I mean, I want to run with the best. I think we have the capabilities to.
So what's your plans for 2020? Are you going to do the Pro Stock Tour full-time or just select a date?
To be totally honest, I don't really know at the moment, and I think that's still planning ahead. We have to see how the late model goes right now, just see how we progress in it, and I know hopefully we'll keep running late model races all around. I'm hoping to get to go back to New Smyrna maybe a little bit later. Maybe the Snowflake is in run right now, but really I'm just looking forward to any races that I can do because I love being in the seat.
Who are you looking forward to race against at Riverside?
Yeah, it'd be really cool to race against Dylan Blancor, and he's always been one of my idols in racing. He's so humble, and I mean, he's just a really nice guy to be around and really tough racer and aggressive. I always watched him and Cassius go at it head-to-head, and I always dreamed of being there one day, and now I am.
Well, we look forward to seeing you at Riverside. And for any fans that want to kind of keep in touch with what you're doing, do you have any social media or anything?
Yeah, on Instagram, you can follow me at Austin McDonald, or even Facebook, King Racing, and Austin McDonald Racing. Just anywhere there'll be King Racing, hopefully I should be there too.
All right. Well, you're going to be in the King Racing 13 at the 150?
Yep. Yes, sir.
All right. Well, we'll see you then at Lucas Oil 150. That's Austin McDonald. And best of luck coming up, my friend.
Thank you.
Big thanks again to Austin McDonald, Rolly McDonald, Jason Hathaway, and Jerome Tracy for joining myself on Victory Laps today. It's getting me fired up for the final race of the year at Riverside, and we are going out with a bang. After the Lucas Oil 150 and the Napa Sportsman Series and the East Coast Mini Stock Tour, we are going to have a sensational celebratory fireworks display to end off the evening. And as it sits right now, we're going to crown some champions as well in the Sportsman Series and the East Coast Mini Stock Tour. Matt Vaughn leads the points in the Napa Sportsman Series, and Dave Matthews leads the points in the Passion Flooring and Interiors East Coast Mini Stock Tour. Just to highlight again, notice the special 4 p.m. start time. The grandstand opens at noon, and you may want to come a little early if you've been at Riverside for a long, long time. I'm going to be roaming around the grandstands throughout the day, and I'm looking for special stories, and I'm going to reward the storytellers with some official Riverside International Speedway swag. General admission tickets will be available at the gate on race day starting right at noon, and there is plenty of free spectator and RV parking for the event, and all camping areas are open except for Family One, which is closed because that's where we're going to have the firework display. And there is no need for camping reservations this weekend. Victory Laps is part of the 50th anniversary celebrations for Riverside International Speedway, part of Throwback Thursday. And once the racing season ends, it's still going to continue. You're going to find tributes, trivia, and a lot more on our website and social media pages, all geared to pay tribute to those who have made a significant contribution to our history. And if you have a suggestion or video or photos, particularly from the years 1969 to 1989, send them along to info@riversidespeedway.ca. Dazzling Dylan, can't wait to see you at the track on Saturday, September 7th. We have the checkered flag waving here. It's Dylan Langille, and thank you once again for listening to Victory Laps, part of the Throwback Thursday celebrations for Riverside International Speedway.